Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest Elif Batuman, the author of The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them. It's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux in a paperback original edition. Elif, both a reader and student of Russian literature, has written an astonishing, hilarious, and moving book about her life as a student of literature at Stanford University and about her travels to Russia. She tells about her visit to Tolstoy's house, her meeting with the relatives of Isaac Babel, and debates about the facts of Tolstoy's death. The book is very cleverly produced, and they had the presence of mind to put a cartoon by Roz Schwast on the cover to let people know that you're not buying exactly a work of literary criticism or exactly a memoir. It's this great mix of how a person can fall in love with literature and with the world at the same time. Tell me, when you first saw this cover, what did you think?
I loved it. I was so thrilled that they did it. The cover shows little windows with some readers of Russian books looking rather anxious, and one of them is confronting a dancing book with a face on it. And I remember when I saw it, I thought that book looked too happy and not scary enough, and I asked if it could look a little bit more threatening, and it looks so threatening. It's fantastic, but still cheerful.
For all of its merriment, Elif is not unfamiliar with the term resignation of the soul. And so it's not as if we're watching a book diss its subject, as sometimes happens. This is a profound understanding that sometimes the resignation of the soul is hilarious.
Thank you. I'm really glad that came across. Resignation of the soul is it's a phrase that comes up in my book and is told to me in the form of counsel by an Aeroflot airline staff member whom I was calling about a lost suitcase that I lost while I was at a conference on the work of Tolstoy with only the pajamas that I wore on the plane. So I'd called to find out about the whereabouts of my suitcase. And she said, are you familiar with our Russian phrase, resignation of the soul? And it was incredibly funny, but it was also a Tolstovan moment that there I was in Tolstoy's house without my clothes. And
Now, you first read Anna Karenina where?
In Ankara, a city with an anagrammatic relationship to Anna Karenina. I was in Turkey visiting my grandmother, and I had run out of English books, and I found an old Penguin 1970s Anna Karenina in my grandmother's apartment, and I read it there that summer.
And it was your mother's.
Yes.
Who began to ask you about which of the men in Anna Karenina loves women.
Yes. She had a theory about that the double plot represents the two kinds of men in the world that, actually the double plot in Anna Karenina is the subject of a lot of debate, and people still, go on about what does it mean. So for my mother, it was about the two kinds of men. And Vronsky is the kind of man who really loves women, and he overpowers Anna and she overpowers him, and they have this, but in the end he just doesn't love her enough, and that's why it doesn't end up well. And Levin, on the other hand, is the kind of man who doesn't actually like women. He's more interested in agriculture and politics, and just women are not his thing, but he's able to have a happy marriage with Kitty. So my mother's interpretation was that this was a book about how it's better to choose Levin than to choose Vronsky.
Because as I told you before, my own mother felt that Anna was crazy. to leave a man who loved her because she didn't like the size of his ears. And I'd have to sit with my mother and explain to her that the ears stood for so much more.
They what stand was... for what's between the ears, right?
Exactly. What did you discover to be the thing that compelled you about Anna Karenina?
The first thing that compelled me was I hadn't read a lot of very long novels at that point. I was I mostly read the kinds of books that were made for young people to read, which was not the huge industry that it is now, but was already, you know, I read a lot of Babysitter Club books and a lot of series, The Great Brain and all of those things like that. So I mean, I'd read some novels, of course, but nothing as long as Anna Karenina, nothing as subsuming. And the first thing that struck me was how long it must have taken him to write it and the kind of commitment. I mean, I wrote in the book that, you know, Tolstoy was clearly not subject to the tyranny of leisure that I felt myself subject to, and that he hadn't been embarrassed to spend all this time writing a book rather than, you know, playing Frisbee or going to a barbecue, which, I mean, I felt in constant guilt for not wanting to go outside and play and throughout my childhood. And I don't know, I'd seen big books before, but I somehow didn't make the connection until then with Anna Karenina that this was an alternate life, an alternate form of living.
You have said and say in the book that you never thought of yourself as someone who wanted to be an academic person or who wanted to teach literature, and yet you found yourself there. How was that?
Well, it largely happened by accident. I actually, my original plan after I finished college, I ended up in graduate school kind of by chance. I mean, it was, I wanted to be in the same city as my boyfriend, and we both, and I you know, I was unfit for any normal productive form of human activity. So, of course, I applied to graduate schools. And then I ended up at Stanford. And my plan was that at the same time as I was, you know, that I would stick around for a year or 2 years and read some books and get paid and eat avocados and it would be wonderful. And in the meantime, I would be writing a novel. And then when I finished the novel, I would, you know, leave graduate school and go on to the next thing. And for many reasons, that turned out to not be a practical plan. I didn't have time to write while I was in classes, and then I took some time off and was trying to write a novel then. And I write about this in the book. It just got – I produced this very, very, very long document that was not really a novel. And then I broke my elbow and had no health insurance and went back to Stanford where I had very good medical care. And – I don't know. By the time I looked up, 5 years had gone by, and then all I had to do was write the dissertation and then leave. So I figured I might as well get the piece of paper.
But it seems as if when you were there, you discovered the passion of the Russian novel. And this is a passionate book, it seems to me.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Actually, yeah, that kind of makes me revise what I just said. That was one aspect of the academic lifestyle that I did change my mind about, was that I realized that it was a large body of highly trained people whose job is to interpret the, you know, classics of Russian literature and all literature, and that's all they care about, that's all they do, and it's a wonderful and beautiful thing that exists in the world, and I was happy to be part of it for a while.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking with Elef Batuman about her book, The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them. I've been telling young people who are having trouble starting to teach, I said, you don't understand. What you teach isn't really part of what they learn. What they learn, if you're a good teacher, they're seeing someone fascinated by a subject. And they may never have seen someone fascinated like that before. You provide an example of what it's like to fall in love in a way that changes your whole life and doesn't involve a civil ceremony.
Yeah, when you describe it that way, it sounds like the early church and the, you know, charismatic exemplar who's going to spread the word through their person. I think there's some truth in that, yeah. With the best teachers.
Yeah, with the very best teachers. And you've had some of the best, and you've gotten part of what the book explores is that the academic life gives one the possibility of meeting the people that one thought one loved, or at any rate, what's left of them. The conference about the great Russian Jewish writer Isaac Babel that you supervised brings the very eccentric, still living relatives mm-hmm. and a worldwide scholar set mm-hmm. to discuss Babel and what he meant, and people offering fur hats to put in display cases, and a sense that what a teacher does is bring things back to life.
Oh, that's really beautiful. It also changed the idea that I had of reading as this something that happens in private and that everyone has their own interpretation, which is the kind of idea of reading that I was brought up with. And I found it really exciting that there's this other kind of reading that is, it's collaborative and it's somehow very touchingly literal minded. I mean, things that, you know, visiting the writer's house, meeting his relatives, things that, you know, in a objective intellectual sense, you would think, how can this possibly bring me closer to this great work of literature, which exists in some other transcendental realm and where, you know, the relationship is between me and the book. And that's all true. But there is a certain kind of closeness that you, I mean, this the kind of literalness and the going to the archives and the looking at all the stuff that existed at the time that the book was written, it really does bring another dimension and produce another narrative, which is very exciting to live with.
Now, here we have Isaac Babel, probably one of the most vibrant writers that anyone could read who wrote in the last century. And you met his daughter and a whole flock of the crazies who worship him. Tell me about Babel's daughter, Natalie, who was a scholar of his life and work. What was she like?
She was fantastic. I represented her dialogue in the book all in capital letters. I mean, one of the copy editors queried something about, you know, that when she was whispering, how could that be in capital letters? but it was. I mean, it wasn't because the volume of her voice was so high. It was because there was just something larger than life about her. And the things that she would say were just so, I don't know. There's a point in the book where I talk about the Smiths song, "Some Girls Are Bigger Than Others." That was a song where I never really understood what Morrissey meant by this observation that some girls are bigger than others. But looking at Natalie Babel, it really just seemed that she was much bigger than everyone else who she was talking to. Again, I'm not saying that she was a physically large person, but just that I don't know, everything about her seemed larger than life.
We discover Elif wanting then to offer only the most vibrant ways of approaching a writer or a work of literature. So when she's going to Russia to Tolstoy's house and she wants the department at Stanford to send her, she says, well, I have a theory that Tolstoy didn't die in the way they say he did, that he was poisoned, that he was murdered, and I'm going to prove it. I want to see the home grounds. And what are your suspicions when you get there? What's the name of the house?
It's the estate at Yasnaya Polyana. It's his family house. Actually, the origin of that, it was slightly less noble than you make it sound. It was because I had actually written a conference paper, and I was going to Yasnaya Polyana to this conference to deliver the paper. And then so the paper was accepted, but then I had to get the funding from Stanford for the airfare. And I found out that there were actually two kinds of grants being offered. One was for delivering a paper, and another was for field research. So I was thinking a lot about there must be some mystery that can only be solved by my physical presence at Tolstoy's house. And I couldn't think of what that mystery would be. The obvious avenue was to think of some question that could only be resolved through looking at Tolstoy's books at the archives, which would have taken a long time. And I didn't have anything like that in mind. And then I was actually watching the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And in the news at that time, they were exhuming King Tut. And the idea was to investigate whether King Tut had died of natural causes or was he murdered. And there was this great moment where Jon Stewart is shining a flashlight on his face. And then I thought, you know, Tolstoy, it's perfect. And when I started reading about it, I realized that, I mean, I'm sure that he really did die of pneumonia at the advanced age that he had reached. But there were, as a story, it's fantastic because there were multiple people who had incentive to want him dead. His death was in a whirlwind of sinister and almost manic circumstances. So it made a very plausible story once. That essay about Tolstoy's murder appeared in Harper's first, and I was contacted by a journalist from Columbia who wanted to Columbia, South America, not the university, who wanted to report on this new theory that, you know, Tolstoy had been murdered, which is, you know, he said it's appearing now in the American press, and he wanted to report on it as if it was a real story, which I thought was
well, you know, in terms of making things live again, it's viable. His wife, threatened with not being in control of his copyrights, which he was going to give to a really crazy,
really crazy
acolyte. Tell him about that.
This crazy guy, Chertkov, whose his name actually means, of the devil in Russian. And he was one of these. So Tolstoy attracted these manic followers who would camp out at Yasnaya Polyana. Chertkov, they really had a friendship after a while. He was one of the most persistent disciples. And so he and one of Tolstoy's daughters had gotten control of the copyrights of his works starting in 1881, leaving his wife with the earlier copyrights. And there was just so much controversy between and conflict between the two of them about what works would be published and the ones that Chertkov published, he wanted the proceeds to go to the people, which meant that nothing would be left for the wife and the nine children in the large household. Also, there was, I think it was Master and Man, one of the stories, the later stories that Tolstoy had written, he had given as a present to his wife, and he said, this is for you, but it was after 1881, so it now belonged to this other guy. And
And they were these disciples asking Tolstoy to be more than Tolstoyan, to completely vegetarian, completely pure, completely devoted to the land, to the serfs, to the religious life, and, you know, a kind of mania that one can only really describe as Russian.
Yeah, possibly. That's true. I mean, and the great thing about Tolstoy and the thing that everyone loves about him is that he was so full of conflicts and he was so ambivalent about everything his whole life long. And, you know, that vegetarian god, I mean, he existed, but together with this other guy who, you know, and they were both in this body, in this incredibly vital body. You know, I write in the book about a paper that was given at the conference about the late age at which Tolstoy learned to ride a bicycle and the late age at which he learned to play tennis, and he would, you know, play his sons into the ground. He would be the last one standing after 4 hours. So he was just this kind of almost a monster of vitality. And as he got older, you could see other people trying to sort of get some part of this vitality and channel it in the directions that they wanted. And meanwhile, there's this kind of pathos and the drama of aging and impending death. So it really is a well set up scene for some kind of horrible crime.
It's fascinating that you would take conferences and papers given at them as sources of high drama and high excitement, because this is what everyone thinks of is the bane of the literary life.
I think it also reflects the fact that some really exciting stuff happens at conferences. I think definitely there's no shortage of boring papers, but when you have that many people who've read that much and who are so smart and so devoted, they come up with amazing stuff. I mean, that paper on Tolstoy and tennis, I didn't make up that drama. That's all true. And it's not an exception that this crazy stuff comes up all the time.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Alef Batuman, author, most recently, of The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in a paperback original. We'll continue after this short break. ¶¶ I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Elef Batuman about The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them. It's a funny yet very moving book in which she discloses her experiences at Stanford University and her discovery of other passionate students of Russian literature, both in academia and during her travels to Russia. Now, you, in the course of this book, get an assignment to go to St. Petersburg, where the ice palace that Tsar Anna
Empress
has had built for her jesters, for their
yes.
marriage, although many people think dwarves.
Yes, there's a common misconception that they were dwarves.
And you are going to find the most improbable things everywhere. That everywhere we go, language and the products of the literary imagination mm-hmm. are at the center of passionate battles that have to do with the continuation, not of literature, but of life.
That's really true, yeah. That was actually one of the things that when I first started studying Russian literature in college that really struck me was anything in the 20th century was actually just how personally involved Stalin was in the lives of writers. That, you know, there are these incredible stories of Bulgakov, you know, basically dying waiting for Stalin's phone call because Stalin had called him on the phone once before for some, you know, involving a contract with the Moscow Art Theater. And there was another famous Stalin phone call where he called Pasternak and asked Pasternak what he thought of Mandelstam. And the order for Babel's execution, Stalin has written something, I don't remember, you know, okay by me, Stalin. And that, you know, in 1940 or 1941, at a time when, you know, Stalin had a lot going on, and that he would take the time to personally sign the death order of a writer. I mean, it says a lot of horrible things, but it also says something about how important literature was.
Yes. And do you feel, because by the end of the book, one of your friends from Stanford has asked you, would you do it again? Would mm-hmm. you give up 5 to 7 years to study literature and languages? And well, what do you say?
Well, yeah, I say absolutely I would do it again just because I can't imagine anything else. Part of what I wanted to get across in the book is how accidentally or fortuitously lives are constructed, even when they're constructed around obsessions, that the way obsessions are formed are by these kind of random accretions. And then by the end, how can you disavow those things, you know, the things that you love and the things that you are?
Well, the book ends, I haven't given up. If I could start over today, I would choose literature again. If the answers exist in the world or in the universe, I still think that's where we're going to find them. Why do you think that?
Okay, why is literature where we're going to find all the answers? I think it's because of the freedom and capaciousness of the novel and of what we consider literature, that even now when there are so many more mimetically accurate forms of representation like TV and movies and so many higher technology ways of capturing the experience of being alive, to me there's something especially direct and especially heterogeneous about novels in particular and literature in general, that I think if you wanted to convey what is the experience of being human and what's the experience of being alive, where are people's priorities really? What are they thinking about? How much are they thinking about work? How much are they thinking about being in love? What do they notice about the weather and what they're eating? And I don't know, just the whole collage of stuff that's in people's heads, I think that it comes across the most in novels. They're a work of art. It's not like, you know, you could read history books too, but history books don't suck you in that way. That's not what they're meant to do. The novel is really, it's made to be, it's really made to be a substitute for life. Reading a novel takes a very long time. It's not like watching a 2-hour movie. It takes amount of time commensurate to time that you could actually live something lived some experience in, and that time goes into producing some simulacrum of a human experience. So for that reason, I think literature is a particularly valuable way of encapsulating the human.
Well, you also say, and I think this was the subject of your dissertation, that characters in novels read other novels, and it's in those novels that they discover what passion is. So that when Emma Bovary reads a romance, or when Don Quixote reads a novel of knight-errantry,
mm-hmm.
they're given a model for what life might be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that many of us who read books would never be able to create the drama or the adventure of our life if it weren't for the thrill and the, I don't know, the extraordinary depth.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So much of living what even we consider a successful or coherent life, it depends on assimilating it to a narrative, and the only place those narratives can come from are books. I mean, we obviously learn social behavior, you know, how to act on a date. You probably learn more about it from a romantic comedy than from a book, but how to assimilate your, you know, much happiness may it bring you. But the actual experience of being alive and understanding how you're, you know, making these life narratives that you know, Freud taught us are the what we all have to do, we need books for that. And also, I mean, the interdependence of literary characters on earlier books that you mentioned, it's valuable at dispelling this kind of romantic fallacy that I think we have a lot of the time, that we should be living somehow authentic lives that are creations of ourselves. And then when we realize that isn't true, then we start, you know, worrying about irony and is can anything be sincere anymore, and acting as if it's a problem. And it's not a problem. That's just the way things are. That's
the resignation of the soul.
It's the resignation of the soul. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Elif Batuman, author most recently of The Possessed, Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Elif, for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Possessed at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.